Hi, thank you so much for joining us today on Modern Tech News on KZSU Stanford 90.1 FM. We have an exciting show today about organic solar cells and how they might revolutionize the solar cell industry. Our guest is Professor Mike McGee, who is an expert on organic solar cells, and he teaches materials science at Stanford. Professor McGee is also the director of the Center for Advanced Molecular Photovoltaics here at Stanford. In today's show, Professor McGee will give us an overview about organic solar cells, what they are, how competitive they are, how efficient his group is making them, and how his group is hoping to change and improve the organic solar cells around the world. I first asked Professor McGee to tell us, what are molecular photovoltaics?
Molecular photovoltaics are solar cells that are made with molecules instead of inorganic semiconductors like silicon. And they're exciting because you can just print them. So picture using a newspaper printing press, but instead of printing newspapers, you're printing solar cells.
My next question was, what can we print molecular photovoltaics on? Can we print them on textiles, perhaps, or on paper?
You can print them on paper and textiles, but they don't work well on those materials. You need a nice, smooth substrate. And so a sheet of plastic or glass is preferred over paper or textiles.
So after printing the molecular photovoltaics on a sheet of plastic or glass, how big can we make those molecular photovoltaics?
They can be almost as big as you want them to be. The roll-to-roll coating machines make rolls that can be a mile or more long and usually a few feet wide. And, of course, people then cut them up. They don't usually ship them at a huge size. But they could certainly be several yards long and so that you could roll them out on a rooftop.
Are there any companies in the Bay Area that are working on molecular photovoltaics?
There are not any companies in the Bay Area yet. There are some startup companies elsewhere in the world. And then there are some of the bigger chemical companies like Merck and BASF that are exploring the possibility of working with this technology, but no main companies doing it yet.
One of the first companies that produced molecular photovoltaics in America is a company called Konarka near Boston. They were started by a Nobel laureate in chemistry in about 2002. I asked Professor McGee to tell us a little bit about Konarka.
Konarka started on the East Coast, but they didn't make it. They ran out of investment a few months ago. And they had to shut down. That was really too bad that they didn't make it. But I think they started way too early. They started in 2002, and the technology wasn't ready at that time. And I think now we're getting to a point where it might be more appropriate to try to scale up the technology.
Since molecular photovoltaics is such an exciting field, and Konarka was such a good company, I asked Professor McGee to tell us what went wrong with Konarka and why did they cease operations?
Well, unfortunately, the vast majority of startup companies, I think in almost all areas of technology, wildly exaggerate how exciting their technology is and what it can do. And, yes, they did put some solar cells on the bus stops up in San Francisco. And, up in the city, they have these red wavy roofs that look really nice on the bus stops. And the solar cells are red and they're flexible. And so they were able to incorporate them into the wavy pattern on those roofs. But the amount of power that was generated was negligible, certainly wasn't generating a significant amount of San Francisco's power. It wasn't even generating a significant amount of the power that the bus station needed. So people should not have had the impression that that technology was, you know, well scaled up, or that I wouldn't say that Konarka had a firm handle on the market there with that demonstration.
I next asked Professor McGee to tell us about his research on molecular photovoltaics and how his group is trying to produce better and more efficient molecular photovoltaic cells at Stanford.
Yeah, so we're working on the same kinds of solar cells Konarka was working on, but I think with a very different timeline. We believe that there are several different kinds of applications, and they have different requirements. If you want to generate significant amounts of power and put it on the grid, then you probably need efficiencies up in the 15 to 20% range. And right now, the best we can do is 11%. You also would need the cells to last 25 to 30 years. And right now, we have them lasting 6 years. So we need improvements on both of those fronts. And then there are other applications where you're not competing with coal or natural gas-fired power plants. They'd be maybe portable applications. Maybe people are out in wilderness areas and they want to carry solar cells with them to charge up cameras and GPS units and flashlights and things like that. And the military especially wants to be able to charge up all of their devices. And, you know, their cost is not quite as important. People are willing to pay a premium to have electricity where they can't otherwise get it. Lightweight is very important, and we think we could print our solar cells on extremely thin sheets of plastic and make cells that you could fit in your pocket. They would just weigh a few ounces, but could generate a few hundred watts in sunlight. So we're working on that. But I'm not going to tell you that it'll be ready next year. You know, it's 5 years, I think, would be highly optimistic. And 10 years is probably a more realistic time frame for those things to happen.
Because we all want to get results right away, I asked Professor McGee why would selecting a material to make organic photovoltaic cells take so long? I thought that making new materials for molecular photovoltaics was just as simple as making materials for plastic bags or plastic clothes.
Well, these materials are far more sophisticated than the plastics used to make, Ziploc bags or trash bags or clothes. And there's more than one material in the film, and they're patterned at the nanometer length scale in a complex way. There are things about how the cells work that we don't even understand yet. And then there are just multiple challenges. You have to get the efficiency up, and you have to get the lifetime up. And you have to use molecules that can be made at a very large scale at low cost. And you have to do these at the same time. You can't find one molecule that gives you high efficiency, one that lasts a long time, and one that's cheap. You have to find a molecule that does all three of those things. So, I just think it'll take time. And a lot of things people don't realize about manufacturing is that the time from when you have one device working to when you have a factory working that can pump these out rapidly, it just can take easily over 5 years if you're doing something totally new. You know, computer companies do it faster because they've been doing it for decades now.
I asked Professor McGee how many other schools around the country and around the world are working on research to select new materials for molecular photovoltaics.
Yeah, I think there's probably over 100, easily over 100 around the world, and the ones that I think do some of the best research outside Stanford are UC Santa Barbara, University of Washington, Imperial College, Cambridge University. There's a lot of people in the Netherlands doing really good work.
One of the recent publications of Professor McGee's group here at Stanford is about dye-sensitized solar cells. The publication says that these dye-sensitized solar cells increase light harvesting. I asked Professor McGee what these energy relay dyes are and what do they do to make solar cells more efficient.
Well, the dyes are what absorb the sunlight, and in one kind of cell, we attach the dyes to titania, that's titanium oxide, and the titania is transparent, and what it does is it just grabs the electrons from the dye. Then we have another material that grabs the positive charge from the dye, and that material carries the positive charge to an electrode on one side of the cell, and the titania carries the electrons to an electrode on the other side, and we're able to get a current.
Selecting different dyes for solar cells can be fascinating because we can use the dyes to change efficiency as well as change the color of the cells.
When we're selecting dyes for solar cells, we want them to absorb as much of the solar spectrum as possible. And so the dyes that make a good solar cell are going to look black because they absorb red, green, and blue. But if we were to design a cell for artistic purposes, we could use colored dyes and we can get any color we want. Those cells are not going to be as efficient because there will be a part of the spectrum they're not absorbing. But yeah, for certain architectural applications, people might want colored solar cells.
So my next question was, how much less efficient are colored solar cells than black solar cells?
The colored solar cells will be a third to two-thirds as efficient as a black cell.
At the beginning of today's show, we mentioned that we need to build more efficient solar cells. Professor McGee will now describe what efficiency means in a solar cell.
Efficiency is how much electrical power you get out of the solar cell divided by the amount of power coming from the sun. And so if 100 watts of energy or power, I should say, is coming from the sun, and we get 16 watts of electrical power out, then that's a 16% efficiency.
How can a person determine the size of a solar cell that we need to run a PC or a laptop computer?
A desktop computer can run around 200 watts, and a laptop is probably around 80 watts. The sun gives us about 1,000 watts per meter squared. And so if you have a solar cell that's 1 meter squared and it has an efficiency of 10%, it will give you 100 watts. And that's about what you need for a computer. And so if you wanted to run a computer straight off of a solar cell, it would need to be about 1 square meter. People probably wouldn't run a computer straight off of a solar cell. Like, they would probably charge up a battery, charge up the computer's battery. And the larger your solar cell, the faster the battery is going to charge. And so if you're willing to wait, you can, you know, use a very small solar cell. So it's just all a matter of how much time people would have available to them to charge it. And it's a question of, are you trying to completely charge it and get off the grid, or are you using the solar cells so that in an unusual situation where you've run out of power, you know, you can get just a little bit more.
Professor McGee had gone trekking in Nepal and they used solar cells on his trek. I asked him to describe his experience in Nepal.
When I went trekking in Nepal, we were out for a month and people had cameras and flashlights. Those were the main two things that they needed power for. Well, we would be hiking in the morning and then at lunch, when the sun was out, they would lay out their solar cell and basically charge up the batteries. And that way their camera batteries lasted for the whole month, and they just had the one set of batteries for their headlamps. That's one example. And then the people who lived in Nepal, they were charging up a car battery. And then at night, most of them just have one light bulb in their house, and a lot of them have radios as well. And their only source of electricity is the solar cell and that car battery. And so they're charging during the day and mostly using it at night.
My next question was, can the molecular solar cells that Professor McGee and his group are working on at Stanford be used in the same way as those solar cells in Nepal?
They excel for that application because they're for the trekker, they're very lightweight and easy to carry, and for getting them into a remote village so that the people who can use them there, the lightweight, the fact that you can easily get it from the nearest city, which isn't that near, up into the villages there, is important.
Next, I asked Professor McGee if molecular photovoltaics were good to use in solar public art projects.
Yeah, molecular photovoltaics pretty much dominate the art scene because they can be colored. The other kinds of solar cells are all black for the reason that they're trying to maximize efficiency and absorb all of the light. But the molecules can very easily be tuned. You can have more or less whatever color you want. And they're thin, they're flexible, and they can be cut. And so they can be used to form lots of different shapes. So they're very good for art.
Hi, thank you for joining us today on Modern Tech News on KZSU Stanford 90.1 FM. And now it's time for our next PSA from San Francisco Classical Voice. Comprehensive information on Bay Area classical music concerts can be found at the San Francisco Classical Voice website, sfcv.org. For daily, weekly, or monthly information on classical music concerts throughout the Bay Area, simply visit sfcv.org. Molecular photovoltaics are made of organic materials, for example, like plastic. We hope that they will change the economics of solar cells in the near future. In the next segment, Professor McGee will talk to us about the economics of solar cells today.
A lot has happened in the last 5 years, particularly in China. Very large factories have been made there. And one thing they do to bring the cost down is they build large factories to make pure silicon right next to large factories that make solar cells, right next to factories that make glass panels to package the cells, right next to a factory that puts it all together into what we call a module. And by doing things at large scale and having everything nearby, they've been able to bring the costs down dramatically. And that has allowed the industry to grow some years by 90%, and a bad year would be 40% growth. And so the economics are definitely changing very fast.
So while China is building the less expensive solar cells, I asked Professor McGee if the United States was spending more on research to make better solar cells.
Yeah, the United States spends more on doing long-term research at universities and national labs. And I'd say China invests more in building manufacturing capacity. And they tend to give very low interest loans to companies, whereas the United States funds universities and national labs to do the longer term research.
So comparatively, does the United States spend more on research in making better solar cells, or does China spend more on making solar cells that are less expensive?
Oh, they're spending vastly more money in China than we are here, probably 20 to 30 times more over there than here.
But that is government spending. I next asked Professor McGee about spending by the American investors. For example, the investors here in Silicon Valley, do they spend money on solar cells and solar cell companies?
Interest from investors has dropped considerably over the last 5 or 6 years. 2005 to 2008 or so, there was just tremendous amount of excitement, and nearly every venture capital firm felt that they had to invest in at least one solar company, and some invested in many. And that has dried up almost completely right now. And so the startup companies are having a very difficult time raising the additional investment they need. And a lot of them have met their milestones, and they're selling their cells, or they've got the costs down to where they originally planned, but no one had anticipated the $40 billion investment in China, and that the costs would come down so quickly there. And so right now, people who have cells at $2 a watt, they can't sell them for $2 a watt, so they can't make money. And so we're in a situation right now where the it's hard for the American companies to do well, and the investors don't seem to be thinking of the long term, and so a lot of them have pulled back.
In one of his talks earlier this year, Professor McGee mentioned that China produces half the world's solar cells. I asked him if this was still true.
That's right.
So my next question was, if China produces half the world's solar cells, who do they sell them to? Who is their biggest market? Is it the United States or Europe?
Most of them end up in Europe. There have been very successful programs for installing solar in Germany and Spain and Italy especially. And a lot of them end up in the United States. And within the United States, California and New Jersey are the number one and number two states. Japan is another country that has an energy shortage, and they really like to install solar cells.
Professor McGee earlier had mentioned that the cost of solar cells today, the inexpensive solar cells, are about a dollar a watt.
The panels we're buying here are the Chinese panels, and they're at a dollar per watt. And economics sort of dictates that if that's the going price, regardless of what it costs the company to make them, that's the price you can sell them for. That's what the customer is willing to pay right now. And and so companies whose costs are much higher than a dollar per watt either have to operate at a loss, or they have to stop running their factories.
Another option is to look at the research that Professor McGee and other groups around the country are doing to make better and more economical materials for organic solar cells.
Yeah, that would be the long-term solution.
So being an expert in material science and an expert in the solar cell industry, how does Professor McGee and his group go about selecting materials that will become the next generation of solar cells and become better and more efficient solar cells to use here in this country and around the world?
You can't get too caught up in worrying about what something is going to cost. You're going into the unknown. You have no idea what's going to happen. You don't know what can be done and can't be done because no one's ever tried to do it before. And you're exploring, and you're hoping that you're going to get high efficiency and long lifetime and low cost, but you don't know. And you know, as you go through this process, you try to make estimates of how efficient it could be, how long the cells could live, and what the costs might be. And if the numbers look really bad, if it looks like the costs are going to be 100 times higher than you need them to be, you may have to reconsider that research program and do something else. But in this case, you know, the projections come out looking promising. We know that printing can be extremely fast and extremely cheap. Newspapers would be, you know, a great example there. And then the molecules that we're using, they're not that different from the molecules used in paint. And so we know there that the costs can be low. And, you know, that's what gives us, I think, a justified hope that we can get there in 5 to 10 years.
Thank you so much for joining us today. This is Modern Tech News on KZSU Stanford 90.1 FM. Our guest, Professor Mike McGee, teaches materials research and material science at Stanford University. He is an expert on organic solar cells. We have been talking to Professor McGee about the economics of solar cells. My question now is, how do people talk about the cost of a solar cell?
So not that long ago, just 5 or 6 years ago, the cost for a module was up around $5 per watt. And 3 years ago, it was at $3 per watt. And now it's all the way down to $1 per watt, which is really exciting and, you know, causing the industry to grow rapidly. The target that a lot of us have in mind is 50 cents per watt. We believe that if the cost was that low, and then we could also install them at about 50 cents per watt, then the electricity from solar cells would cost about the same as electricity from a coal-fired power plant. You know, that's the point at which a lot of utility companies would very happily switch from coal or natural gas over to solar cells. For coal, it's a whole different process. You have to switch and talk about the cost of electricity in cents per kilowatt hour. And for coal, it can be just a few cents per kilowatt hour. And if you take a solar cell that, if you install it at $1 per watt, and you calculate the cost of that electricity that you'll be getting for like 30 years, the $1 per watt translates into about 5 cents per kilowatt hour. And so that's where you get the comparison that you need to be about $1 per watt to compete with coal or natural gas. Unless people really get serious about preventing the pollution from coal and natural gas and say, you know, we're willing to pay extra for the solar cells, in which case solar wouldn't have to get that low.
one of his recent video talks, Professor Mike McGee mentioned that there are about 225 startup companies that deal with solar energy in Silicon Valley. He'll next tell us a little bit about those companies.
Yeah, there are something like 250 startup companies, mostly in the United States, and the vast majority of those are right here in Silicon Valley. And they have many different approaches to making solar cells better. Some of them make lenses and mirrors that concentrate light on small solar cells so you don't have to use as much solar cell material. Some of them build trackers that point the solar cells at the sun. Some of them build equipment that other companies use to make solar cells. Some of them build the packaging that protects the solar cells from the weather. Some of them are more focused on the installation itself. So there are just lots of companies out there with many different approaches.
How do we find out more about those startup companies that deal with solar cells here in the Bay Area?
It's not always easy to find information about startup companies. Some of them are operating in so-called stealth mode, and they really don't want you to know what their approach is. They think they have some amazing idea, and they don't want people copying it. So usually the information you can find on a website is going to be extremely limited. So yeah, it's not so easy to get information about startup companies.
I next asked Professor McGee about the leading companies that deal with solar energy in the Bay Area today.
I would say the leader in the area would have to be SunPower. That was founded by Dick Swanson, who invented the technology here at Stanford before he left to start the company. And they're one of the biggest solar cell companies in the world. First Solar is based out of Toledo. And they're also a very successful company operating on a large scale. You know, NanoSolar and MiaSole have still not had initial public offerings. So they're, I guess, technically startup companies, though they've been around for a decade and have over 300 employees. And then, yes, a lot of the bigger companies are in China. You know, companies like SunTech, for example.
I asked Professor McGee how easy it was to do his research and teach, as well as to keep informed about the many startup companies that are in the solar cell field in Silicon Valley.
Well, the great thing this quarter is my class is on solar cells, and so keeping up with the technology and preparing to teach are the same thing for me. Of course, it's great to live in Silicon Valley and be so close to the companies, and a lot of my former students are scattered around Silicon Valley working for these companies, and we love to get together and talk about what's going on. And it's one of those things, you could never do it yourself just poking around on the internet, but when you have a network of people sharing ideas and information, you can stay on top of what's happening.
I asked Professor McGee if the research that his group does at Stanford only deals with the materials for the organic solar cells, or do they as well think about how the solar cells will be covered and installed in the future?
For the longer-term research, we're just working on the cell itself, and I'm in the material science department, so we focus on the materials. We're aware of what's going on with the installation, but that's someone else's job to deal with that. I mean, that said, because our panels are lightweight and flexible, that could potentially change the way the installation is done. Our cells are smaller than 1 inch by 1 inch, and we don't have to test them outside, so we're not concerned about the weather. that would be something you deal with later. You know, you get your efficiency up first, and then you deal with those kinds of issues.
Thank you for joining us today on Modern Tech News on KZSU Stanford 90.1 FM. Our guest today is Professor Mike McGee, who teaches material science at Stanford University. And now it's time for our next PSA. The International Committee of the Red Cross and Red Crescent is an impartial, neutral, and independent humanitarian organization. It protects the lives and dignity of victims of war and internal violence and coordinates international relief activities. The ICRC also seeks to prevent suffering by promoting and strengthening humanitarian laws and principles. For more information or to donate, please visit www.icrc.org. That's www.icrc.org. Next, we will discuss how important solar energy is to developing countries.
Yeah, in developing countries, if you combine a solar cell with a battery and a light, then you have a way to provide people with light at night. And, you know, if you think about it here, the difference between having 20 and 21 light bulbs in your house is probably pretty small. But the difference between having no light bulbs and one is truly profound, and you know, it gives children the opportunity to read at night, which is important because they often work during the day. And so it really changes people's lives in the developing world to have a solar cell with a battery and a light.
Because most of the people in the developing countries are poor, I wanted to know if they could afford solar energy.
I mean, if you go into villages in the developing world, if you go where people, they can afford to eat properly, they'll usually have solar as well.
Next, Professor McGee will discuss some of his courses at Stanford. The first course he'll talk about is the quarter-long course he teaches to graduate students, and the second course we'll discuss is a three-hour module that he teaches online.
I teach a 10-week class that's primarily for graduate students at Stanford, but there are also a few undergraduates who take it every year, and we really go over how solar cells work and how they're made in quite a lot of detail. We compare the 7 or 8 leading technologies, and we have a lot of discussion. I try to get the students debating the advantages and disadvantages of the technologies, and we try to predict which technology will ultimately be the winner and, you know, the one that will lead the market in 15 or 20 years. And, you know, then the three-hour module is, of course, much shorter, and I'm not able to get into as much detail, and I can't assume that all of the students know a lot about semiconductor physics. And so the intended audience is not just engineers, but also people who invest in renewable energy and people who want to understand the whole renewable energy landscape. And it's targeted for policymakers who are trying to help renewables provide more of our energy. And so it's just a nice overview of solar cells.
In Professor McGee's graduate class about solar cells, he points his students to the exciting career opportunities that are available in the solar industry. I asked Professor McGee to share with us some of the exciting career opportunities that are now available in this industry.
Well, I think that getting solar cells to a point where they can provide electricity at the same cost as a coal-fired power plant is one of the most exciting things, you know, anyone could possibly do. If we completely pull it off, I think it'll be one of the most important technological achievements of this century. And a lot of people agree with me on that, and that's why there are so many students who take the classes and who want to do research on solar, and they want to go work for solar cell companies. And some of the advice I give them is try not to do what everybody else is doing. Try to look out on the fringes. Try to find the problems that other people haven't fully appreciated, and you know, see if you can think ahead, figure out what's going to be exciting in a few years instead of what is exciting to most people right now.
So I asked Professor McGee if that was the reason why he chose to work on organic solar cells rather than silicon or thin film solar cells.
Yeah, that's right. You know, I didn't want to work on the well-developed silicon technology when I started my career here at Stanford. I wanted to take a chance on something that could potentially be better than silicon. And yeah, we've had a lot of fun doing that.
A lot of the work that Professor McGee and his students do is done in the lab. Professor McGee also teaches a lab called nanocharacterization. He'll now describe what nanocharacterization means.
Yeah, that's a lab class for the undergraduates, and I really enjoy that one. It gives me the opportunity to work with students who are just starting their research careers. And it's not a lecture-based class, it's a lab-based class. So I get to really show them how I like to do research and kind of share with them the advice that I've picked up over the years from my mentors and my colleagues.
In 2007, Professor McGee got lots of awards. The first was the Vance D. and Arlene C. Kaufman Faculty Scholar Award, the MRS Outstanding Investigator Award, and the Moore Innovators Award. So I asked Professor McGee what was the most special event that happened in 2007.
Yeah, the most important thing is I got tenure at Stanford, so I got to keep my job. And compared to the alternative, that was definitely a great outcome.
So I had to ask, how does a professor get tenure at Stanford? Do engineering professors have to have publications as well as patents, or are publications enough?
No, they don't look too much at patents. They look at publications, and the most important thing is they get letters from 15 people who are considered to be the leaders in your field, and you need to be well regarded by those 15 people. The bad thing is you never get to see those letters. So I guess if you get tenure, it's bad because presumably the letter said something nice and you never get to see it.
Congratulations are due to Professor McGee, not only because he got his tenure at Stanford, but because he is the director of the Center for Advanced Molecular Photovoltaics at Stanford. Next, Professor McGee will discuss what this Center for Advanced Molecular Photovoltaics does and why it is important.
5 years ago, I got a somewhat strange but amazing opportunity. There was an invitation from Saudi Arabia to put forth proposals to do research and to form a partnership with a new university called the King Abdullah University of Science and Technology. And they were offering up $25 million for four centers to be formed. And we were successful. And so for 4 years, we've had a partnership with them. And it's been really exciting in two ways. I have been able to go over to Saudi Arabia each year and watch the university grow from at the beginning, when I just saw them laying the foundation for the first four buildings. And now it's a completed university, and they have amazing equipment and over 100 faculty members, and they have three classes full of students at this point. No one's gotten their PhD yet. That'll take two more years. And then on the other level, it's given us the resources to have 15 professors and their students working together to develop molecular photovoltaics. And that really allows us to tackle the problem from every direction. The chemists can design and make new molecules that are just what we need for these solar cells, and then people like me can make the solar cells, and people like Rainer Dauskart can study how durable they are and make sure they're not going to fall apart. And people like Mark Brongersma can make transparent electrodes so that the light can come in and we can still pull the current out. So it's really great having all these people working together with one common goal.
Is this type of collaboration between universities usual, and is funding at that scale available easily?
It's pretty rare to have a partnership at that scale and to have funding at a level of $5 million per year. It's much more common that one professor at one university might work with one professor at another, just a pairing. It's a little bit unusual to have 17 groups, counting two in Saudi Arabia, working together. And, we're located at Stanford, Berkeley, USC, Georgia Tech, EPFL in Switzerland, and KAUST in Saudi Arabia. So that's a pretty big partnership.
Hi, you're listening to Modern Tech News on KZSU Stanford 90.1 FM. Our guest today, Professor Mike McGee, teaches material science at Stanford University, and his group specializes in molecular photovoltaics. I asked Professor McGee what got him interested in studying solar cells and organic photovoltaics.
All the way since high school, I've been interested in energy. My dad worked for a propane company, and I started to hear about climate change in high school and was concerned about that. But in college, I really enjoyed learning physics and didn't worry too much about applications or what I would do with my career. I just had fun learning physics, things like the theory of relativity. Then in graduate school, the new area in science that was getting really exciting was nanotechnology, which is patterning materials at the nanoscale. And again, I didn't worry about a specific application. I just wanted to do the most interesting science I could possibly be doing. And then when I started at Stanford, I was looking for a new area to work in, something that nobody else was doing, an area that I could have to myself. And I had some ideas for using nanotechnology to make a new kind of solar cell. And it suddenly felt really nice that I was working on something that was not only interesting, but it also was solving a problem that I felt really needed to be solved. And interestingly, in the year 2000, hardly any students were interested in solar cells. And there wasn't a single professor at Stanford working on them either. The funding agencies were not interested in funding the research. But I did find one student, Kevin Coakley, who said he really wanted to work on solar cells. And so for a while, it was just the two of us. But then I started to notice that more and more students wanted to work on renewable energy, and some of the best students in the country couldn't find advisors at the top schools, and they were really pretty frustrated over it. And I found I didn't have a whole lot of competition for getting these students. So I thought, now this is really nice. I like the science, I like the application, and I'm getting some of the smartest students in the country. And then the funding fell in place. We got the Global Climate and Energy Project at Stanford about 10 years ago. Four companies, Exxon, Toyota, Schlumberger, and General Electric, gave $225 million to Stanford. I wish it was all for me, but only a small bit was for me. But by small, I mean a couple million dollars over the last 10 years. You know, that really made a big difference. And so then I had the funding in place, and we were able to buy all the equipment we needed. And then the buzz for solar really started to pick up around 2005, and then everybody wanted to do it. But we'd already been doing it for 5 years, and was able to get more funding and more students. It really worked out, having that synergy between exciting science and a really important application.
I asked Professor McGee where can people go to find out more about the research that he does on organic photovoltaics.
If you just type my name into Google, my website will come right up. And we put some videos on there every year or so. I usually give a lecture somewhere that gets recorded, and some of those are designed for a technical audience of specialists, but some of them are designed for a much broader audience. And then for those who want to get into the details, all of my publications are on my website, and you can just download them.
We started today's show by discussing organic solar cells, and we mentioned that Konarka, the first company to produce organic solar cells in the United States, recently ceased operations. This was very bad news to start the show with. However, I'm hoping to end the show on a good note, and that's why I'm asking Professor McGee, how is the solar industry doing today?
So, the solar industry is very turbulent right now. And if you read some articles, you would think that the industry is doing horribly because you see companies going out of business. But if you read other articles, you see that it's actually doing quite well. And a lot of the companies that have gone out of business did so not because customers don't want their product, and it wasn't that they weren't able to get their technologies to work. It's just that some other companies have done extraordinarily well, and they've improved their technology far faster than anyone thought they could. And so the prices for solar cells have plummeted downward, and that's allowing the industry to grow really rapidly. So how the industry is doing, it really all depends on your point of view. And you often see, in economics, you see that when there's a shortage of something, prices go up, and the prices attract lots of companies to come in and to make whatever there's a shortage of. But often there's an overcorrection, and in the solar industry, we're seeing that right now. And now the number of factories that have been built in the last couple of years was probably a little bit too much. And so right now, supply exceeds demand, even though the demand is going up at 40, 50% per year. Supply went up by more than 100% per year. And so I don't think you'll see a lot of new factories in the next few years. But then, because the demand is growing and growing, I think you'll see more factories in a few years.
This sounds like good news for the solar industry, and I wanted to know if there were any brave new companies that used printing to print organic solar cells today.
There's a company called G24i that is printing what's called a dye-sensitized solar cell, and there are other companies doing research on printing. I don't think there are any companies selling a product based on molecules. NanoSolar prints an inorganic material, and they are selling products.
I asked Professor McGee which science book influenced him the most and helped him choose a career in science and research.
By far, the book that has had the most impact on my career was Richard Feynman's autobiography. And the title is Surely You're Joking, Mr. Feynman. I read that when I was 14 years old, and I knew more or less right away that I wanted to be a scientist and that I wanted to be a professor. I would recommend that book for anyone. It's really a funny book. He did a lot of hilarious things, and he was, you know, one of the greatest scientists who ever lived, and had a really good way of thinking clearly and looking at problems, and definitely shaped the way I think about a lot of things.
My last question was, how does Professor McGee like teaching at Stanford, and why?
I definitely think teaching at Stanford is very special. I guess I'll probably never know what it's like to teach somewhere else. But this place is very special. So many of the students want to start up their own companies, and a lot of my students have started up their own companies. So there's an enthusiasm here that I'm not sure you see anywhere else. And we've seen so many companies nearby do really well, you know, Apple and Google and many others. And, you know, many of us know people at these companies, and we know that an idea that we generate here at Stanford could profoundly change the world. And, you know, we believe it because we've seen it happen. And so when I teach a course, while I do try to teach them the facts and the information, and I teach them how to work certain problems, I also try to inspire them. And I do my best to forecast where the technology is going to go. I try to give them suggestions on, you know, what would I do if I was their age. And of course, some of my predictions go nowhere, but in the past I've told them to go into renewable energy, and a lot of them took my advice. So it's really exciting to work with the students and then see them, you know, go out and get jobs using the stuff that I've taught them here.
Thank you so much for joining us today on Modern Tech News, and we would like to thank our guest, Professor Mike McGee, very, very much for his time and for this interview. Professor McGee teaches material science at Stanford University. You've been listening to Modern Tech News on KZSU Stanford 90.1 FM.